Scripture reading will be found in Isaiah. Let's turn to chapter 5. We'll be reading 1 through 7. Isaiah 5, 1 through 7. Please stand after you find that, please. I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyards. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut down a winepress as well. He then looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and men of Judea, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could I have done for my vineyard than what I had done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it only yield bad? Now I tell you what I am going to do about my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and the briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. A vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are the garden of his delight. He looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, and heard cries of distress.
If you've known me for a little while, you've probably heard me say that the key to happiness is low expectations. Then you're never disappointed. And, disappointment is a really hard thing to deal with. And it seems like the more you anticipate, and the more you look forward to something, that, you know, sometimes the bigger you set yourself up for that letdown. And here in this passage that we've just had read for us, you get to see that this is something that the Lord also experiences. Which is kind of an odd thought for me as I prepared the message these weeks, thinking, well, how can God, who knows the future perfectly, how can God, who knew and has in fact destined the end from the beginning, ever experience disappointment? You know, it's often when we experience disappointment is because we think something is going to be different than the way it turns out. We think something is going to be better than the way it turns out. But in this case, God knew the way it was going to turn out. In fact, he told Moses exactly how it was going to turn out when the nation began, 1400 years before the time of Christ. And then you come 700 years later to the time of Isaiah, and you find out that God has a great sense of disappointment. He has a huge letdown with his people, with his vineyard. Now, I don't know if anyone here has ever been to a vineyard. Raise your hand if you've been to a vineyard. I have. I lived in California for 3 years. You can't really live in California without going to a vineyard at one time or another. My wife's aunt had a home that was right next to a vineyard and, you know, looked out over the vineyard in the backyard. And vineyards are some of the most beautiful places in the world. In fact, I was looking online this week and didn't do a PowerPoint, so I wasn't able to share my pictures with you. But I had some beautiful pictures of vineyards. And, you know, the nice thing about vineyards is that they do well in rocky soil, and they do well on hillsides. And there's just something about hillsides that make for gorgeous vistas. And the rocky soil, it allows for a lot of drainage because you don't want too much moisture in the ground for the vine. You want it to get lots of rain, but you don't want the moisture to sit there. You want the wind to be able to blow through and to cool off the vine and to provide a dry soil that it gets water at a moment but doesn't sit in water, because that's not good for the grapevine. Now, Israel, surprisingly, is one of the oldest winemaking nations in the world. In fact, the vineyards of the Promised Land predate the conquest. When Joshua led the people into the Promised Land, the vineyards were already there. Vineyards were already well established, and they got to enter into a land that was flowing with milk and honey, a land of beautiful vineyards, was truly the promised land. Now, sometimes we see pictures of the promised land today, and it doesn't necessarily look so appealing. And there are reasons for that. And we'll be talking about some of that as we go through the message this morning, that it may not have always looked the way that sometimes the Middle East looks today. But it is one of the oldest winemaking regions in the world. It goes all the way back to the book of Genesis, when after the flood, Noah landed his ark in the Middle East and planted a vineyard. And, of course, that didn't go very well. But then the 12 spies entered into the land. They brought back the vine, the grapes, to show what a great productive country it was that God was bringing them into. And so the vineyards of Israel, Lebanon, southern Turkey, even archaeological evidence clearly demonstrates that these were the world's first wine regions, predating Europe by roughly 2,000 years. And we think of Europe often when we think of wine. No, but really it was first in the Middle East. And this was a major source of revenue for the nation of Israel. Judea was a premier winemaking center all the way through the biblical time period, all the way up to the New Testament, all the way through the Roman period. They were exporting their vintages throughout the Mediterranean basin, and this was one of the strongest supports of their economy. And in fact, you can only find one book in the Old Testament that doesn't mention vines, vineyards, or wine. And that book is the book of Jonah. It's the only book that doesn't mention it. Psalm 104 celebrates the natural wonders of God's world and praises God for how He sustains His people. It reads, "He makes grass grow for the cattle. He plants for man to cultivate, bringing forth fruit, food from the earth, wine that gladdens the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread that sustains his heart." All these passages from the Scriptures show us what an important part of the culture wine and viticulture, a word that I came across this week, I thought was a cool word. It means the taking care of vines, and grapevines in particular, in ancient Israel. Now, Israel is a small nation. It's about the size of New Jersey. And grapevines, they grow on the rocky hills there, and they recently, in the last 50 years, the vineyards of Israel have been making a comeback. Because in 700 AD, the Muslims took over, and the Quran prohibits all wine, and so they completely destroyed all the vineyards in Israel and wherever they conquered. And from that period, 700, up until 1950 or so, there were no vineyards again in Israel. But now, once again, there are vineyards, and family farming is going on there. They put enormous labor into harvesting their vines, crushing the grapes, fermenting them. And in ancient Israel, this was part of their annual cycle. There were three main activities that kept ancient Israelites busy. They were farmers. They would grow grain in the winter during the rainy months. And then they would take care of their animals year-round. And they would tend their fruit trees, olive trees, and grapevines during the heat of the summer. So it's an agrarian culture. Almost everyone in Israel farmed. This was a family thing. The families ate and drank together from what they produced. Because they had the farmer being busy in the winter months with the wheat, and then being busy in the summer months with the grapes, this provided everything that they needed together with their animals for their family, and then when they had a surplus, to be able to trade in that as well. So when Isaiah comes and sings this song, in Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 and following, he's probably coming at the time of year of the grape harvest. And I want you to know that the time of the grape harvest was really a lot of fun in ancient Israel. It was probably one of their favorite times of the year. When they were harvesting their grapes, they'd go out into the fields, and they would build little shacks, little booths out there. And they would live out in the field during the time of the grape harvest, because a lot of times their fields were very far removed from their houses. And rather than travel back and forth in the morning and in the evening, they would just pack up their stuff and go live in the fields while they were getting all the harvesting done. And then when they were done with those booths that they had built out in the vineyard, they would take them up, and they would travel to Jerusalem for the Festival of Booths. And they'd already have their booth prepared, because it's what they used out in their field for the harvest. They'd take it to Jerusalem, where they celebrated the fact that God brought them out of Egypt, that they lived in the wilderness, wandering in tents, in little booths, and they would do that there with their new wine harvest. in the city of Jerusalem. So when they were out in their fields, they were a joyous people. You come over to the book of Isaiah chapter 16 and verse 10, and this verse gives you an idea of just that type of happiness, joy, exuberance that was surrounding this time of year. And now in this verse, it's pointing out the opposite, that these things are being taken away. But normally, this is how the grape harvest went. You see there in verse 9 that is talking about the vines of Sibma, which is actually in Moab. They were also have their own vineyards in this country next to Israel. And this is a judgment oracle on Moab. Here, you see the shouting over your summer fruits and your harvest has fallen away. So when they were harvesting, they would actually be shouting, shouts of joy as they brought in the grapes. And they see in verse 10, there's gladness and joy are taken away from the fruitful field. In the vineyards also, there will be no cries of joy or jubilant shouting. So the fact that there were these things is evident from the fact that God was going to take them away. It just gives you a sense of the atmosphere that was in the air. And people are shouting and really giving thanks and having that kind of Thanksgiving celebration type of feeling that we have during our harvest. And he comes and sings this song of a vineyard. Now he starts off and he doesn't tell them who he's singing about. He says, it's a song of my beloved. A well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. And this is to disguise the fact that this is a spiritual parable. In fact, what he's trying to do is he's just trying to sing a song like everyone else would be singing. Everyone else is singing songs. Everyone else is shouting for joy. Now he comes and he's got his instrument, his lyre, and he says, okay, now I'm going to sing a song for you about a vineyard as well. However, this is not a song of joy, but it turns out to be a song of deep disappointment. If you think about the labor that goes into producing a vineyard, now, I've never had to do that labor, but to produce the vineyard, you see some of the things that go into it in these verses, and this is exactly historically accurate. Isaiah knew it, he saw it, all the people that he's singing to, many of them had themselves experienced the work that it took to build a vineyard and the joy that came out of it. He sings about how his friend dug it all around, how he removed its stones. Now, we tell you that the vineyard does well in rocky soil, and the soil in Israel is very rocky. But you still have to remove the stones. You still have to remove the large, big stones. Now, if there's going to be, you know, little pebbles left in there, that's good to help the drainage and all of that. But there's lots of big stones, and you got to take those out. And those stones that you take out of the ground, well, you use them to build the walls. You use them to build the fortress, as you see, is going to be here to protect the vineyard from invaders. So he dug it all around. He removed its stones, and that's a lot of work. I lived in Wyoming, and there's rocky ground in Wyoming, and we had to remove some stones from part of it because we wanted to plant some flowers, and it was really hard. I mean, those stones, they're packed in there, and you try to get your spade underneath one of them, and it's jammed up against another one, and it, yeah, you know. So I know what it's like to try to remove stones from rocky ground, and maybe you do as well. And then he went out and found the most choice vine. He went out and purchased it from another vineyard, the one that was producing the best grapes. This is what they would have done. And he got the best ground. You see that's on a fertile hill there in verse 5, chapter 5, verse 1, excuse me. So he's got the best ground, he's got the hard work that's going into it, he's got the best vine, and so then he builds the tower of protection in the middle of it, and he also hewed out a wine vat. Now the wine vats that were hewed out, they were hewed out into slabs of stone. And you can go online, I'm sorry, I don't have my PowerPoint, and look at pictures of these huge slabs of stone that are hollowed out into wine vats. And there would be an upper part where they would put the grapes, and then people would stomp on the grapes, and then they would drain through a little canal that was also hollowed out into a large holding tank. And they've excavated thousands of these all over Israel. And it was a huge part of their society. And so they understand the work and the labor that goes into it with the expectation, with the looking forward to, all this hard work is going to pay off for me and my family in many years of fruitful harvests. A vineyard is meant to produce. A vineyard produces something that is an element of joy. Even as we read in that Psalm 104, that wine gladdens the heart of man. And I think this is why Isaiah chose the vineyard in particular for this parable, is because the harvest of the grapes is the most looked forward to and joyous time in their culture. And so it's a season of expectations fulfilled. However, when those expectations are not fulfilled, the sense of disappointment is so strong. When it says that he cleared it of all the stones, I want you to go with me to a psalm, Psalm 80. This picture of the vineyard, as I said, it's throughout the scriptures, and it's a metaphor that is used very often. Psalm 80 is one such example of another poetic section of scripture that uses this picture in order to illustrate spiritual truths, and it's illustrating the same spiritual truths. Psalm 80, pick it up there in verse 8. Here Asaph writes about God's history in dealing with the nation. You removed a vine from Egypt. You drove out the nations and planted it. You cleared the ground before it, and it took deep root and filled the land. And you can just stop right there. So when you think about the work that God did in order to plant his vine, he had to clear out all the stones. That clearing out of the stones here in Psalm 80 is referenced as the removing of the nations, driving out the nations, so that he could plant his vine in the soil on that fertile hill. So what we see here is that the parable is actually kind of more like an allegory, and that each part of what is mentioned here does have a correspondence with some particular act of God in caring for his people and in putting them into a place where they could produce good fruit. The planting with the choicest vine, that is, you see in those same verses, that taking that vine from Egypt. And I think this refers to the heart of the people, the giving of the law through Moses, the godly leadership that they had in the days of Moses and Joshua. And I think it even goes on to the judges that God raised up and the prophets. And the watchtower that is built in the middle of it could well be a reference to the fortress of Zion and the establishment of the house of David. This idea that God has richly blessed his people and given them everything that they need to succeed in serving him is something that has already appeared in this book of Isaiah. If you turn back to Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 21, Isaiah had mentioned there lamenting how the faithful city has become a harlot. She who was full of justice, righteousness once lodged in her, but now murderers. See, God had established Jerusalem. He'd established Judah. He'd given them his law. He'd given them the prophets. He'd driven out the foreign elements. He'd taken away the false worship. He had removed all the elements that were going to drag them away from the Lord and corrupt their worship and their spiritual lives. And so he planted them pure, having Moses as their lawgiver, the very word of God guiding and leading them. God himself being king over the people, and then providing a human king like David, a man after God's own heart. And through David establishing the fortress of Zion, giving them peace over all of their enemies, not allowing anyone to subject them to slavery, so that they could serve the Lord in freedom, and they could follow his word. But the faithful city turned from following God and prostituted all the things that God had given to her, and she became a harlot. This is the disappointment. This is the lament that this song turns into. You see there in verse 2, he expected it to produce grapes, but it produced worthless ones. Literally, that word for worthless ones is stinking things. He looked for grapes, and all he got was the stink fruit. Can't do anything with it. It's useless. Now, stink fruit is useless. And normally, that doesn't bother us too much. You know, if you go out in your yard and you find some stinking little berries that you can't do anything with, you just cut them out and throw them away, and doesn't bother you. But when you've invested everything into a vineyard, and you've worked hard, and you've been waiting and hoping to see good fruit, and you go out into those fields and you find nothing, even though you did everything right, and the conditions were perfect, well then, the stinking fruit is really stinking. And you hate it. And it drives you crazy. And that is the sense of emotion that God feels. That is the sense of utter disappointment and dejection that God is in his heart when he looks on his people and sees, I have done everything for them, and they have produced nothing. Before telling them who he's singing about, in verse 3, he asked the people to judge. What should be done with this vineyard? The best ground, the hardest work, the choicest vine. What do you do with something like this? And I suppose he probably gave them time to answer, very much like Jesus did when he told his parable about the vineyard in Matthew chapter 21 and Mark chapter 12 and Luke chapter 20. It's recorded in all the synoptic gospels. Reminds me of the time when Nathan came to David, told him a parable about the rich man whose friend came and visited him from a far off country. And even though the rich man had all kinds of flocks and herds, he was too stingy. He was too selfish to take any of his own lambs, any of his own sheep, to provide a meal for his visiting friend. There was a poor, powerless neighbor next to him who just had one little sheep. And that little sheep, he'd loved it since the time it was born. Grew up in his house. He treated it like a pet. And that man, instead of taking his own, he went and took that one sheep that that man had, and he butchered it. Because the poor man had no legal recourse. The man who was rich had the power, he could do what he wanted to. And he butchered it for his friend and served it to him. And Nathan the prophet said, okay, David, you're the king. What should we do in this situation? And David said, that man deserves to die. We should put that rich man to death for what he's done and the injustice. And here, the Jewish people probably condemned themselves as well. They probably said, tear it down. Destroy it. Unleash all of your disappointment and anger on the vineyard that didn't produce anything. What more was there to do that was not done? Why? When I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? Now notice in verses 3 and 4 that the speaker has changed. In the first couple of verses, it was the singer who was singing about his beloved. But now in verses 3 and 4, it's the beloved who is speaking. And he's saying, my vineyard, what should I do with this mess? And the word of the Lord, the pre-incarnate Christ, he expected it to produce good grapes, but it didn't. And so the question is, how can God, who knows the heart of man and knows the future, have hoped for righteousness from fallen people? How could God expect the people of Israel to obey when he knew that they weren't going to? It's a good question. You want the answer, or do you want to figure it out? Well, I'll give you my answer. I don't know if it's the answer. God always expects righteousness because it's right. Sin is irrational and it makes no sense. Therefore, it always surprises God. He always has a sense of why? What? That doesn't make any sense. That's not right. That's not what's supposed to happen. We should have that sense more often. We should feel disappointment over sin like God feels disappointment. We should see that sin is irrational and righteousness is natural and right And we should expect righteousness in the way that God does. And we should be aghast and appalled at sin the way that God is. You know, we live in a sinful world and stinking things are produced everywhere. And so we just come to expect it. Well, that's only natural. Actually, no. It's only unnatural. Sin is not normal. Now, it might be common. It might be everywhere. But it's not normal. Normal is righteousness. Sin is an aberration. Sin is a confounding aberration. And the greatest disappointment that can be imagined. So what's God's decision? What does he say? Verse 5. So now, let me tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will. Over and over again. God does not just let the vineyard fall apart. His sense of disappointment is too great. His indignation is too strong to just let it be. Think about it. Put yourself in God's position. Put yourself in the farmer's position. You lost everything on this field. You feel it deeply. You know that it's not right. There's anger. There's fury. And God unleashes that anger and that fury. He removes its hedge, the protection that he had put around it. He had kept the nations at bay. He had given them a king and an army that was able to defend the nation so that they would not be oppressed by the peoples, that they would not be forced to do things the way the nations do things. But they went and did the way the things the nations did them anyway. They followed after the nations by their own free will. And so God says, what good is the protection? You don't need the protection. You're destroying yourselves through the ways of the nations anyway. So I'm going to remove the protection. And now the peoples will destroy you. Not only that, he says, I'm going to break down its walls and it can become trampled ground. Not only will people come against it purposefully to destroy it because the protection is gone, but it'll just become trampled upon because it's worthless ground. Might as well walk on it, make a road out of it, because it's not growing anything good. Walk across it. And he says in verse 6, even further, I will lay it waste. You can see the farmer out there tearing down the wall, tearing down the trellis, ripping up the vine, venting against the worthless field, the worthless vineyard. It will not be pruned or hoed. Briars and thorns will come up. And then he says, finally, I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. Now, people can try to do that, and you can see the angry farmer saying things like that, but there's only one person who really has the power to do that. And that's why, then in verse 7, Isaiah explains, the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. And the men of Judah, his delightful plant. He looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. He looked for righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. Now this poetry here is strong. There at the end of the verse 7, when he says the word justice, the Hebrew word for that is mishpat. And the word for bloodshed is very similar, mishpak. So he looked for mishpat, but he found mishpak. Looked for a good grape, and he found this little stinking thing. And the same thing with righteousness and a cry of distress. The word for righteousness is tzedakah, and the word for distress is seyakah. Tzedakah versus seyakah. I liked one translator. He said, the Lord looked for right, but behold, riot. The Lord looked for decency, but behold, despair. Come with me to Jeremiah chapter 2. Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 21. Now, to help you further understand the importance of the expectation of the vineyard, I want to remind you of a law in the Old Testament. And while you're turning to Jeremiah, I'm going to quote, just tell you what the teaching was in Deuteronomy. When the army gathered together, God was gracious, and He allowed anybody that had built a house and hadn't dedicated it yet to leave the battlefield and to go home and enjoy his house, because he'd spent all this time building it and all this labor, and he hadn't gotten to enjoy it yet. And so God says, I don't want this guy to die in battle without being able to go home and enjoy the house that he's built. The same thing for somebody who was engaged to marry a young woman. The sense of expectation and hope that the young man approaches the wedding day with, as he has courted this young lady, as he has engaged this young lady, they planned the wedding. God says, you can be excused from the battle to go home and get married. Well, there was one other thing that God allowed people to be excused from the battle for, and that was if they had planted a vineyard but had not yet begun to use its fruit. So that just tells you how important this idea of planting a vineyard and yielding fruit from it was to their culture and society. Come over to Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 21, and here God's disappointment is palpable. He says, I planted you a choice vine, a completely faithful seed. How then have you turned yourself before me into the degenerate shoots of a foreign vine? How is it possible? Again, you see, God is confounded. He's befuddled by the nature of sin that makes no sense. It is unnatural. It is irrational. It is impossible. Not the way things should be. Not the way things go. While we're in Jeremiah, come over to chapter 12 and verse 10. I told you that in the 700s, the Islam conquered the Middle East. They destroyed all of the winemaking, all the vineyards that were over there. And the culture that they brought in instead was sheep and goats. And sheep and goats, well, they led their free grazing led to the total deforestation of the land of Israel, to the point that no natural forest remained in Israel by the 900s. Much of the country became desert after that. Look what Jeremiah chapter 12, verses 10 through 12 say. Many shepherds have ruined my vineyard. They have trampled down my field. They have made my pleasant field a desolate wilderness. It has been made a desolation. Desolate, it mourns before me. The whole land has been made desolate, because no man lays it to heart. On all the bare heights in the wilderness, destroyers have come, for a sword of the Lord is devouring from one end of the land even to the other. There is no peace for anyone. Many shepherds have trampled it and made it worthless. This happened in the time of Jeremiah. It happened later on in the time of the Islamic conquest, that Israel has continued to turn away, Israel has continued to reject, Israel has continued to become this worthless, stinking vine, and God has continually brought His judgment upon them, and they have experienced it in history. Also come over to Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 15. Move one book after Jeremiah, well, two books, Lamentations is in between them. But Ezekiel chapter 15. A vine is useless unless it produces fruit. And that's the whole point of this chapter. Let's read it together. The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, how is the wood of the vine better than any wood of a branch which is among the trees of the forest? Can wood be taken from it to make anything? Or can men take a peg from it on which to hang any vessel? If it has been put into the fire for fuel, and the fire has consumed both of its end, and its middle part has been charred, is it then useful for anything? Behold, while it is intact, it cannot be made into anything. How much less when the fire has consumed it and it is charred, can it still be made into anything? Therefore, thus says the Lord God, as the wood of the vine among the trees of the forest, which I have given to the fire for fuel, so have I given up the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I set my face against them. Though they come out of the fire, yet the fire will consume them. Then you will know that I am the Lord, when I set my face against them. Thus I will make the land desolate, because they have acted unfaithfully, declares the Lord God. Vineyards may be beautiful, but that's not the point. The point is to produce. Come with me to the New Testament, The Gospel of John. John chapter 15. The vineyard of the Lord of hosts, the people of Israel, the men of Judah, his delightful plant. And yet, they turned themselves, they twisted themselves into some degenerate root, some degenerate vine. Jesus came into the world, and he said this, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser." The people of Israel, people of sin, people of failure, people of unnatural response to the mercy and the grace of God. The person of Jesus Christ, a person of righteousness, a person who always did what was pleasing in the sight of the Lord, a unique man, and in one sense, the only man who ever acted in a natural way. The true vine. Righteousness is found only in the Lord and in those related to Him. And so Jesus goes on to teach, "Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, He takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, He prunes it so that it can bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, so neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him, he bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up, and they gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned." Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. The God of the Old Testament is the God Jesus Christ. He took the vine, he took the branches that were not abiding in him, and he cast them into the fire because they were useless for anything else. He does it the same today. The point of being in Jesus Christ is to bear fruit. It's not to be a good-looking vine. To be a fruit-producing vine. When you abide in Him, when His words abide in you, when you do what He says, you keep His commandments, as He says in verse 10, "If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love," then you bear much fruit. But if you do not, you are thrown away as a branch and dry up. Continue in verse 7. "If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish and it will be done for you. My Father is glorified by this." And then verse 11. "These things I have spoken to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be made full." The singing, the shouting that was going on in the vineyards as they brought in the grape harvest, as they trampled out the grapes and the juice flowed into the vats, as they carried that to Jerusalem and they celebrated their feast of booths and what God had given to them. That joy, the joy that is overflowing, the joy that has to be expressed, the joy that fills the whole heart, that's the joy that Jesus Christ wants you to have, and He wants you to have it by hearing His Word. What are the things in life that you find joy in? Where does your joy come from? What are the things that inspire your songs? Or do you even have any songs? If you don't have any songs, where are you going to get them? You know, in this world, you're going to have disappointment. But when you put your hope in Jesus Christ, the true vine, there is no disappointment. The expectations that you have of God are too small. And your expectations will never get big enough for God. He is able to do exceeding abundantly beyond all that you ask or think. His joy is the reason that He came to share it with you, that His life can be in you. You have to listen. You have to obey. His commands are not a burden, but to the one who believes in Jesus Christ by the power of God, they are life. They are joy. Amen. We'll stop there. There's always more, but that's a good spot.